950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Happy Thursday afternoon to you. It's Brett Johnson on FYI Politics. Finally seeing some warmer weather outside as that snow is almost gone, at least. But glad to see that we're going to be having a return to the 60s next week on our temperatures. Feeling a little bit more like spring and some chances for you to go outside. Certainly very important to do since it's tough to be cooped up inside all day. With all these stay-at-home restrictions, at least for me, I would go nuts if I were to be stuck inside all the time. So I definitely take advantage of getting outside whenever I can. By the way, today's show is pre-recorded, but do have a couple of interviews lined up for you a little bit later on, as we are going to be speaking with Roberta Fernandez, as she is going to be talking about conscious napping. Now, you might be sitting there thinking, that sounds kind of like a play on words, but it's a really interesting concept that can help not only with mental health, but also dealing with pain as well. So look forward to talking with Roberta a little bit later on the show. And by the way, she might sound familiar, being that she used to have a show here on the AM 950 airwaves. Also ahead, we'll be speaking with Max Richmond for the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare to talk about a topic that just seems to continually come up, and that is a payroll tax cut. Yes, it's like the zombie that won't ever die. But unfortunately, this thing was resurrected yet again a few days ago when at one of the Trump administration press conferences, they were talking about how not only do they want to eliminate the payroll tax cut on a temporary basis, now apparently they want to do it on a permanent basis. So we're going to revisit that topic with Max Richmond and the prospects for that actually happening. Because even though we do have a Democratic House, unfortunately, we already did see a bit of a cut to the payroll tax in a way. So we'll get to that a little bit later on the show as well. But first, I want to talk about the post office, because this is something that has certainly been in the news for the past few days, with the fact that the post office is really struggling among the pandemic with fewer people using the mail service. That, of course, is one contributing factor as to why the post office is struggling. But as you're probably aware of, we've talked about this many times on my show. Matt certainly mentioned this on his show. What's also not helping the post office is the fact that due to that congressional bill that was passed way back in 2006 during a lame duck session, they have to fund their pensions 75 years in advance, which is absolutely nuts. There is no other private business, let alone government agency, that is required to fund their benefits 75 years in advance. So that's also a major contributing factor as to why the post office is struggling. So there's some concerns. Well, could the post office actually shut down later this year because of a lack of funding? The post office also did not get any funding from that most recent stimulus bill, and the prospects of getting any extra funding for the post office in the next stimulus bill, not really looking very good. So a lot of people have come up with ideas in terms of trying to help the post office. In fact, we had one emailer, Shay, send us a note saying that we should buy extra stamps now and save them for use later. As Shay writes, that this will provide profit for the post office to offset their current difficulty due to loss of business during the epidemic. The vultures are circling, hoping to dismantle our national post office system through privatization, disrupting plans for vote by mail and other aspects. So Shay says, contact your Congress member to resist a postal service takeover, and definitely agree with Shay that we need to keep the post office around. Now, the other day, Matt brought up something interesting about the post office on why ultimately it probably won't get privatized. And he was talking about how, well, of all people, bill collectors probably don't want to see a privatized post office due to the fact that, well, are those bill collectors really going to want to pay those extra fees to use a UPS or a FedEx to send out those bills? So it could be an interesting alliance between the post office and even bill collectors trying to stop privatization. Sometimes you have strange bedfellows when you're trying to fight something that isn't very good, like trying to privatize the post office. But then I also think there's another reason for why the post office ultimately probably won't be privatized, and that's the fact that, well, are UPS or FedEx really going to be wanting to deliver to really rural areas around the country? Talking about places like, let's say, Embarrass, Minnesota. Or think about any rural towns where there's only a few people that live. UPS and FedEx aren't exactly going to be thrilled to deliver to those areas. So, yeah, I'm at least looking for some reasons for optimism as to why the post office won't ultimately be privatized, but nonetheless, they are still going through a financial crisis. Now, one of the members of the Postal Service Union actually has some other ideas as to how the post office could raise some funds. I'll turn things over to Mike Moen with Minnesota News Connection, who recently spoke with a member of the Postal Service Union about some of these ideas.
The combination of cash flow problems for the U.S. Postal Service and the lack of access to financial services for many Americans is renewing calls for postal banking. Supporters say the move would benefit a large number of Minnesotans struggling during the pandemic. The coronavirus crisis is highlighting funding problems for the Postal Service. Stephen DiMatteo of the American Postal Workers Union says the situation is dire.
The economy is ground to a halt, and early projections suggest that mail volume could fall by as much as 50% by the end of the summer.
The Postal Service already has been dealing with revenue declines. President Donald Trump and other Republicans have resisted a financial rescue and instead want the Postal Service privatized. Meanwhile, the average underserved household spends roughly 10% of their annual income on banking fees and interest. DiMatteo says that's why allowing post offices to have a banking component would give struggling families better options during difficult times. He says branches could offer things such as paycheck cashing, ATMs, and small loans. DiMatteo says while these banking services would give the Postal Service a much-needed revenue, it would not put profits ahead of public service.
If the Postal Service could offer a low-cost alternative to the payday lenders and the loan sharks and the check cashers that are out there, we think working class and lower-income people would really stand to benefit.
DiMatteo says for those who don't have access to a checking account and will have to get their stimulus payments by mail, it could take several weeks. He says that's why other alternatives would be helpful. He adds that some proposals under postal banking already could be implemented without congressional approval, but others would need consent. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
So gotta love that idea, the Postal Service getting into banking. There's a lot of reasons why this is a good idea, including the fact that if you look at a lot of areas, either in very urban areas or even some rural areas, there's not a lot of access to finding banks or payday lenders. At least legitimate payday lenders that aren't going to be charging you an exorbitant interest rate. So I just did a search on Google Maps looking for banks in North Minneapolis, bank branches, and it's kind of crazy how there's really not many banks in the North Minneapolis area. Basically, you have one that's located near Highway 100 and Bottineau, and then another U.S. bank branch, which is located near Broadway and 94. But that's pretty much it in the North Minneapolis area of actually finding a bank branch. So if you were to expand that to the post office and allow them to do banking, that would certainly help out a lot of people. And like I mentioned just a few seconds ago, this is also true in rural areas as well. And I think the need to have a bank, or if we were even to allow the post office to do loans, that would certainly be helpful as well, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Because unfortunately, as a lot of people are going to be struggling to pay their bills, they're probably going to have to take out these loans. And if you look at how the loan industry works, unfortunately, there are a lot of predatory loan places out there that charge just these absolutely crazy interest rates. So certainly some good ideas there from Stephen DiMatteo of the American Postal Workers Union. In fact, I'll work on trying to get him on the show so we can talk about some of his ideas in more detail. All right, coming up next, we're going to switch gears and talk about Social Security and yet again, another push for a payroll tax cut. We'll be speaking with Max Richmond of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare up next on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, right now we're speaking with Max Richmond of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare to talk about a topic that just will not go away, unfortunately, and that is a payroll tax cut. Max, thanks so much for joining us on the show today to talk about this.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I mean, this thing is like out of a bad zombie movie. This thing will keep coming back and back and back after it looks like we've finally gotten rid of this idea of cutting a payroll tax cut. But yet again, we've seen this brought up by the Trump administration, this time trying to make a permanent cut to the payroll tax. So can you talk about, are special interests really this dead set on cutting the payroll tax cut? It seems like we talk about this every few weeks, yet this topic still keeps coming up.
Yeah, kind of reminds me of Groundhog Day.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it just keeps, as you say, keeps coming back and back. I don't really understand why the president doesn't appreciate the way the Social Security program works, and it seems determined to go over and over this issue every couple of weeks. I know maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago he talked about the payroll tax cut. A couple of weeks ago, I think it was just last week, he said that he'd even like to make the payroll tax cut permanent. Well, Social Security is funded by the payroll tax. And if the revenue goes away, the program is in jeopardy. You know, I watched the presidential primary debates in 2016. There were 17, I watched, I think, all of them. There were 17 candidates running for the Republican nomination, and there was one who said time and again, I won't touch Social Security and Medicare, said it repeatedly. And yet here we see once again the president talking about cutting the payroll tax. That is not consistent with not touching the Social Security program. The president either fails to understand or doesn't care about the fact that workers and employers contribute the FICA tax that funds the Social Security program. We know from the trustees that make a report every spring, the program is going to run out of money to pay full benefits. It won't be bankrupt, but there will be a shortfall of about 20% in 15 years. If less revenue comes into the program, that date is going to be moved up much closer to the present. And on top of all of this, with this enormous unemployment we're seeing, there are fewer people paying payroll tax. That in and of itself should be a concern. We should be talking, and the president should be talking, about protecting Social Security by bringing more revenue into the program, not starving the program of the revenue it needs to function, to pay retirees, to pay disabled, to pay survivors, to pay children. Millions of children get by in life because Social Security is there for them. So, you know, if the revenue flow is decreased, and that is aggravated by cutting the payroll tax, we're going to have a serious problem not too far into the future.
So as the administration proposed making this payroll tax cut permanent, and you were alluding to this, well, that's how the program is funded. So essentially that would eliminate the program. He didn't talk about, or others in an administration talk about, another way or alternatives to funding the program if the payroll tax is permanent, correct?
That's correct, and you know, this is probably one of the most insidious ways of getting rid of Social Security. There are plenty of people that have been opponents of Social Security for a long time, whether it's cutting the benefits, cutting the cost of living adjustment, privatizing. You remember that, President Bush, the day after he was elected, we were sitting in our boardroom, the staff, at the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. He came to the podium. First thing out of his mouth was, I've earned political capital in my reelection, and I'm going to use it to privatize Social Security. And he did try, but he did not succeed. And this is, I think, another effort to starve the program of the revenue it needs to provide benefits. And it's just the opposite of what we should be doing. And keep in mind, the last stimulus bill that passed already has in it a provision where employers can defer their contribution, contribution to the FICA tax, Social Security program, for the rest of this year and pay half of it back next year and the other half the following year. Now, is that going to happen, or are we going to that's a scary proposition in itself. Are we going to get to the point where those people who have ignored the huge deficit that the Trump administration created in increasing that deficit in the tax cut of about a year and a half ago, all of a sudden are they going to say, well, you know, we can't raise taxes. We're going to make sure that these employers don't follow through on the law that exists now and have to repay the payroll tax that's been deferred. So there are so many variables that are in play. The last thing that we need right now is for the president to be talking about a payroll tax cut and making it permanent. That doesn't make any sense, and I hope some of his advisors who have a better grasp on the way this program works and why it's so important to so many people will get him to stop talking about it and stop generating interest in it.
And going back to what you were talking about, this provision that was put in the recent stimulus bill, this is what has me concerned, because naturally when you would look at the House of Representatives, you would think, well, there's probably not much of an appetite there to phase out the Social Security program. But then we see that provision put in that stimulus bill, which certainly would have me worried, because on the surface, at least, it would seem like members of Congress are probably not real excited about the idea of cutting Social Security or completely eliminating a program. But then you look at some of these Trojan horses that are put in these bills. So are you still optimistic that members of Congress will remain firm and not make any further cuts to the payroll tax, or are you a little more pessimistic, being what we just saw?
Well, there are some key members of Congress in positions where they can have a lot of influence on the future of Social Security. Congressman John Larson of Connecticut, a strong proponent of not only protecting but improving Social Security. He's the chairman of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Social Security and the chairman of the full committee. Congressman Richie Neal of Massachusetts is a strong champion for Social Security. So I'm hoping that they won't follow the president's suggestion. I'm sorry that in the last stimulus bill, which was supported by Democrats as well as Republicans, this payroll tax deferral for the rest of this year on the part of employers was included. We opposed it. We opposed the same kind of cut to Social Security, a smaller cut, but temporary, when President Obama pushed it, a Democrat, when we were in the recession and after the 2008 election. But it seems like, the idea of payroll tax holiday or making a cut in the payroll tax permanent is something that some Democrats have supported. I guess I would say cutting the payroll tax is a bad idea, and it's a bad idea that it's not just Republicans have a monopoly on this bad idea, some Democrats as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, you are most definitely correct about. And that was part one of my conversation with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Coming up in part two, we'll talk about why eliminating the payroll tax is a bad idea, if the reasons weren't obvious enough already. And then some ideas Max has in terms of trying to increase funding for Social Security. That's on the way next on FYI Politics. We're back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. I want to finish up my interview with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, as we're going to continue our conversation about why a payroll tax cut is not a good idea, and then some ideas Max has trying to increase funding to Social Security. Here's part two of my interview with Max that you were writing about again over at the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, and you were talking about how even if we did implement this payroll tax cut, it would still actually take time to implement and for people to potentially benefit from it. Now, as we've mentioned several times on those shows, those benefits are very questionable as to whether people would even benefit from a Social Security tax. But just in, if we take this scenario and let's say we do cut the payroll tax, it would still actually take a while to implement before people would even feel the effects of this cut in terms of getting more money in their checkbooks, right?
Yeah, well, this is not the best way to provide an economic stimulus.
Right.
for example, the payroll tax cut, it's not going to do anything for people that are laid off or furloughed or otherwise unemployed because they're not paying payroll taxes. So a payroll tax cut isn't going to do a thing for them. It's not going to do very much for contract workers or what's called the gig economy because they don't pay it. They don't pay it for the most part as it is. So this is, you know, this is. You mentioned the Trojan horse. I'm concerned that this is a Trojan horse, an effort to undermine the program when we should be doing just the opposite. Thankfully, there are members of Congress who are going to try in the next stimulus to increase the monthly benefit of Social Security, as well as for veterans and supplemental security income beneficiaries through the end of next year. I know Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, and Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, the ranking Democrat on the Finance Committee, are going to be pushing a $250 monthly benefit through the end of 2021. For Social Security benefits. And I mentioned John Larson of Connecticut, the chairman of the Social Security Subcommittee of Ways and Means in the House. He's been promoting legislation to strengthen Social Security for a couple of years now, and I'm hoping that he will include in the next stimulus bill some improvements for widowers' benefits, and make an adjustment in the threshold for the minimum benefit, which is so low, and it would increase the minimum benefit by about $70 a month. That may not seem like a lot, but if you're living on Social Security mostly or entirely, that is an awful lot. So, you know, we need, as I said at the outset of the interview, we need to improve the program, not jeopardize it in a way that is going to ultimately lead to the demise of the program.
And ultimately, can you go through some more details in terms of some of the ideas you guys have over at the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare? And I know you were alluding to this as well, some of the ideas people of members of Congress have to improve the program, talking about the funding mechanism, because the talking point
well,
we
one
often
thing
hear
that
is
I that think is often overlooked in the discussion about Social Security. The program needs additional revenue to operate. The agency is going to have to cope with a lot of increased cases, expected survivors benefit applications. We have advocated adding $400 million to the Social Security operating budget to handle all of the claimants' concerns and requests. You know, there's an 800 number for Social Security. And if you're willing to wait on hold forever, you might talk to somebody and get some help. But the resources just aren't there to handle the increased work that the Social Security program is going to be facing. And this next stimulus bill, I think, should include improvements to the program along the lines that I mentioned, increasing the minimum benefit, adding a set amount for the rest of this year and maybe next year, and raising the the administrative budget of the Social Security program. We've sent letters to the House and the Senate endorsing these proposals. I'm hoping they'll make it through when the Congress, I understand they're reconvening May 4th, and maybe that's when they'll take up the next stimulus proposal.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been speaking with Max Richmond of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. You can find more information about them at ncpssm.org. That's ncpssm.org. And Max, as much as I like chatting with you, I'm hoping this is the last time we'll at least be chatting about this topic of cutting Social Security.
Well, you know, Brett, I'm afraid it won't be the last time because, as we said at the beginning, some bad ideas never die. And I'm afraid that this topic is going to be something we're going to have to talk about. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to reach your listeners so they're aware of the issues that are so important to Social Security, to the beneficiaries, whether they're retirees or disabled or children or survivors. It's an important program for so many families.
Yeah, definitely. And unfortunately, I think you're right, where even if we have a change in the administration, we're probably still going to see this idea pushed through, as we've even seen from previous presidents as well. So hopefully we're both wrong about that, but I got a feeling, Max, you're probably going to be right that we are going to continue having this conversation.
Well, thank you again. It's always a pleasure to be on the program with you.
Coming up next, we're going to have our We're Still Open segment, where I'm going to be talking about a business that is remaining open amid the COVID-19 pandemic. That's on the way next on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. So we're going to do our We're Still Open segment, where we highlight a business that is remaining open during the COVID-19 pandemic and how they can still help you out. So joining us now to talk about that is someone you might be familiar with here on the AM 950 airwaves. It's Roberta Fernandez, who is the president and founder of Conscious Napping, as she joins us now. Hey, Roberta, how are you doing today?
Hey, Brad, I am doing fine, healthy, so I'm very happy about that.
Yeah, certainly a good thing. So recently you developed this new thing called conscious napping. So to me, at least when I hear that term, it kind of sounds like an oxymoron to me. Conscious napping, what is that? So can you explain a little bit more detail about what exactly conscious napping is?
I can. And you know, you're right. It is designed to be a play on words. People think like, well, they'll say, so can you help me sleep better? Well, actually, the answer is yes, because sleep is one of the things that conscious napping addresses. But it really is our innate ability to tap into that deeper part of ourselves, to that subconscious part of our mind, which really runs the show. So it is kind of a play on words, but conscious napping is designed as an employee benefit or a healthcare discharge product. So that's how I market this product. But in the unprecedented time that we're in now, as a word that's going around, isn't it? Unprecedented. I find that, you know, I need to get this out to a much broader group of people, and that is individuals. And so I'm offering a complimentary 5-minute download that I call Inner Peace. And your listeners can get it at consciousnapping.com/innerpeace. And it's just a way for us to step back and take 5 minutes to kind of reset our buttons and lower that stress level.
So how exactly does this work? Is it similar to meditation? And can you explain a little bit more about how it actually works?
Yeah, that's a great question. So conscious napping is guided visualization. And that's been around for years, pretty much every professional athlete uses some form of guided visualization, because what we know from a science perspective is our brains can't tell the difference between what's real and what's vividly imagined. And so when we're imagining things that bring us peace, that help relax us or put us in a scenario, so to speak, that's accomplishing the goal that we're after, if we can vividly imagine that, then our brain thinks it's happening. And so, for example, with COVID-19, you know, we need healthy immune systems, and everybody's pretty stressed out right now about everything that's going on, whether it be the virus itself or their financial well-being. And so it's really important that when we turn that stress off, because stress is detrimental to our immune system. So it's especially more important now than ever for people to be able to take 2 to 5 minutes or 10 minutes and just chill. And a lot of people can't do that on their own because, you know, they've got squirrel mind, right? Their mind is going from one place to the other and they can't quiet themselves. So using guided visualization is a way to have someone help you do the work and you get the results.
Yeah, and it's got to be a helpful tool, because even though a lot of us are spending time at home, being that we have a lot of businesses that are shut down, among other things, even then, it's still even hard to relax at home, simply because you just have the stress of having, well, this different way of life, and this is certainly a tool that people can use to help relax.
Yeah, it really is. And again, a lot of people get nervous when you hear the word meditation, because they're like, oh, you know, I can't do that for an hour. Well, you don't have to do it for an hour. You can do it in short spurts, like with this 5-minute module that I'm offering, because if you can do that frequently, you know, if you could do it in the morning or at night or maybe midday, a couple of times a day, if you'd like, it just takes 5 minutes. It's a way to help your brain shut off those stress chemicals like cortisol, which is a silent killer, and adrenaline, and to release calming chemicals like serotonin, which and melatonin. Those things help you feel better, help you sleep better. Endorphins, that's like your body's natural morphine. So our bodies have this normal way of balancing itself. But sometimes under periods of extreme stress, you know, we need to do something to help it make that shift, because it can't do that automatically. So a short burst of this guided visualization or mindfulness meditation, call it whatever you want. They're all very similar. It's just a great way to help our bodies reset.
So can you talk about how you developed conscious napping? Because what I find interesting is that, well, you speak for yourself, because you actually tried this on yourself before you even kind of released this to the general public. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I can. And so I've worked with clients in a variety of ways. I started out in the corporate sector doing training and consulting around emotional intelligence, which is really about finding out how we process emotions and how we deal with them so we can relate better to other people, and a lot around organizational change. And then I moved through a different career change, and I was working individually with clients to help them deal with a lot of issues like pain and stress and sleep, all the things that, you know, we have problems with in our normal day-to-day life. And so conscious napping is a culmination of really a lifetime of working in different professions and seeing how people, you know, don't deal properly with their emotional state, and helping them find ways that work for them. So specifically the last 10 years of my life, this really comes from working with people one-on-one and taking it into a format, an audio format, that's a little bit more general, that can work with a wide variety of people for a wide variety of issues. So with conscious napping, there's over 50 short modules, all like 10 minutes roughly or less, that deal with various emotional, financial, or physical well-being issues. And then it also has courses on pain management, stress, weight, smoking cessation, things of that nature. There are more like longer term courses. So it's really kind of a complete program. And the Inner Peace module is a really good representation of how quickly you can help yourself feel better.
What I found interesting about this, too, as I was reading about this and conscious napping, is that this is also a way that can kind of serve as an alternative if you're dealing with pain rather than, you know, taking opioids and having some of the negative effects that can happen with that. Even doing something like this can certainly help you in terms of trying to not have to take those pain medications or those opioids.
Oh, absolutely. And so what we know, and again, I'm kind of a science girl. I like to have proof and backing for whatever it is that I'm talking about. The brain doesn't have, and there is no area of the brain that deals with pain. You know, we have auditory areas and visual areas, but there is no center. A lot of what happens with emotion and pain and stress is in the limbic system, our amygdala, people will know, our hippocampus, our thalamus. But pain is based on perception. So it is largely how we experience pain based on what we've been told that it should feel like or that it will feel like or what we've experienced in the past. And so it's really easy to change the perception that people feel of pain. And it's really quite fascinating. Like I say, the brain is this amazing pharmacy, much more powerful than anything we can put chemically in our bodies. I know a few years ago, I had both of my knees replaced at the same time. This is kind of what drew me into this field, was through pain. And I didn't take any pain meds. I used guided visualization. And I did it every day. And I kind of trained my brain for how I wanted to experience that event. And I didn't need drugs. And, you know, not everybody can do that, but everybody can help themselves take less. So whether it's pain management or stress management, like we're all under now, it really doesn't matter. We don't really utilize the full capacity of our brains. And that's why I titled this project, this product, Conscious Napping, because it's our conscious mind that gets in the way. You know, people will react to this interview and say, oh, well, that's just a bunch of hogwash. That's not possible. But science proves it again and again that what we think and what we feel greatly impact what we experience in our lives. And so we can't really separate things out anymore like we used to. Well, that's a body thing. It's body, mind, and spirit, and it is all connected. And this subconscious part of our mind really rules the day over our conscious mind. It's much more powerful, has a lot bigger bandwidth than our conscious mind.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there, because people might be sitting here thinking, oh, well, this is just meditation. It's just all mental. There's really no science behind it. But just to emphasize it again, as you're saying, there is actually a lot of science that you put into this.
Oh, there really is. And I can provide hundreds of studies and reputable. In fact, a couple years ago, Stanford did a huge study on the effect of hypnosis. There was a huge study in Nature about a year later that talked about meditation. And I mean, this is, I don't know, that study is like 50 or 60 pages, and it's really complete. And to be published in a magazine like Nature, a peer-reviewed magazine, is probably the gold standard in science. And so whether we're talking about this idea of mindfulness, which also has a lot of research around it, or guided visualization, all of these things overlap in some way. They're all a little bit different and distinctly different, but they're very, very similar. And the brain actually changes. We know that really good meditators cause neural networks to change in our brain and create new ones. And so this is something that everybody has the capability of doing. It's just that most people don't do it. and there's the rub, right? We think, oh yeah, that's a great idea. It does make me feel better. And then we don't do it. And so any habit, needs repetition because that's how our brains learn. The subconscious mind learns through repetition. So that's why I created these short modules, because people are very busy and we don't have a lot of time. And so they're short things that you can do every day. And by doing things every day, you learn to retrain your brain and how it reacts and basically how you think.
So where can people go to learn more information and access that free module that you were talking about that's available now?
Yeah, so you can go learn about conscious napping at consciousnapping.com. There's a lot of information there. It is not sold to individuals as a rule. However, people can reach out to me at admin@consciousnapping.com if they'd like to purchase something. But the module is there too. So it's consciousnapping.com/innerpeace. And it's just a little 5-minute piece of heaven, let me tell you. You will feel so much better after you do it. And if you do it repeatedly, it just has an exponential effect, just like coronavirus, but in a good way.
Yeah, I like the reverse coronavirus. Yes,
certainly. That's right. Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, we're all talking about the problems, mm-hmm. and we're obsessed with it. You can hardly get away from it if you have the television on or you're looking at your newsfeed. And, you know, I recommend that people stop that. Actually, you don't need to be reading all the horrible stories. We know what the problem is, and you know, you have to stay home. But we need to start focusing on some of the solutions, because our emotional and mental health is affected when these things happen. Our routines are interrupted, our daily life. We may be alone. I mean, I live alone, so I don't have anybody to talk to all day. That's really weird. And if you were with families, you're not used to being with your kids 24/7. And you may love it, you may hate it, I don't know, but it's different. And that change so abruptly and so dramatically is very hard for people to adapt to. So having an outlet like this is even more important today than ever.
Hey, we've been speaking with Roberta Fernandez. She is the president and founder of Conscious Napping, and you can get more information over at consciousnapping.com. Roberta, really appreciate the time today.
Thanks, Brett. You stay healthy.
And that's all the time we have for today on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. A big thanks to everyone who has signed up for a membership with AM 950. Your financial support has meant a lot to us here at the station, keeping AM 950 on the airwaves. And within the next few days or weeks, we'll have an announcement about some benefits you'll get from becoming a member. So make sure you stay tuned for that. I'm back with a live show tomorrow. I'll talk to you then.